Welcome, welcome, welcome to another episode of Meeting You Where You Are, BTSC's own personal podcast. I am one of your hosts, Chris Simon.
And I'm Jada McCray.
This is good. This is good.
I'm getting the hang of it.
You're saying your own name. I don't have to do your intros and all this other stuff. How's your week so far?
So far, so good. I can't complain.
Okay, okay, okay. So we got a few things coming up that we're very excited about. We got the CBT Plus next Wednesday.
Yeah, we're so excited. Ready for the kickoff for that?
Mm-hmm. We just did a new little renovation to our multi-purpose room. We added like the projector screen, the projector, the iPad in the wall. Got some training tables, chairs.
It's awesome.
So when they come through, we're going to let them know how BTSC do it.
I mean, there's only one way to present yourself, you know. You got to come right or don't come at all.
So are we getting the ice sculpture?
I thought about the ice sculpture. I'm not going to lie. And I also thought about having a balloon artist so we can have a balloon art.
And what did you want the balloon thing to say?
BTST. I mean.
In the arts. Did you ever follow up with them?
I didn't. You know what? I felt like I may have been just a little ridiculous. So I
you
can,
a little
I can
ridiculous?
Kind of ridiculous. I didn't.
That's kind of like an oxymoronic
too
statement, huh?
Ridiculous. Not too ridiculous.
Jada ridiculous. Is that an oxymoron or is that synonyms?
When it comes to a celebration, you know, I like to celebrate.
Yeah, you had the. I like you to had celebrate. The. You had the ice sculpture at. She had an ice sculpture at her vow renewal. Her and her husband celebrated a 10-year anniversary, and they did a nice vow renewal.
Listen, if you
and she had a Mount Rushmore ice sculpture.
It was not Mount Rushmore.
She had her face three times and her husband's once.
Y'all too fancy.
He thinks he's so funny.
I said, Jada, what is going on here?
The four most important people in the relationship.
Jada. And dialogue.
And dialogue.
Well, anyway, today I'm excited. You might can't tell because I feel like I'm a little congested.
I can't hear you, a little under the weather.
I took my Flonase. All right. Why don't the doctor just take my adenoids and everything I
asked
him to do?
I'm going
to
tell you, you got to do what your mother said to you when you were little, which is you got to keep your neck covered. Protect your neck. You need a scarf around your neck.
I brought my scarf today.
You need it.
Last time I wore a scarf, y'all tried to joke me.
Because you pulled it out way too soon. It was too soon.
Okay. Now it's too late.
Your neck was sweating.
Now it's too late. Well, anyway, I'm excited today. We have a special guest, my brother, my guy. My man, Earn Maben, is in the building today.
Yay.
Happy to be here, my brother. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So,
and my sister. I apologize.
All right.
It's so funny that I've been trying to get Jada and Earn in a room together for a while. And when Earn came up to I think it was at the old office, weren't we? We were on York Road at the time?
Yeah.
And we were just
it was
talking.
Right before you opened up this spot.
Yeah, right before we moved. And we were talking just about the different things we wanted to do and the grand opening and all that other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Earn just got to talking, man, and I was just blown away.
Yeah.
And then I went to Jade, I said, bro, you needed to be here for this conversation. My guy talks about just the most phenomenal stuff and just down to earth and just has such a great head on the shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, oh my God, I seem like I need to meet. I was like, I'm gonna put it together. And now, what is this, November?
Mm-hmm.
We moved in in January and it's finally getting put together. But I knew
Never question God's timing.
I know, right? I knew that you guys would. I know that you guys are going to kick it off so well because you guys are both prolific speakers. I always say, like, if people ask me to speak about the same thing that Jada could speak about, I would defer for Jada to speak.
My gracious.
Because I always say a lot of, you know what I'm saying, or you feel me, or something like that.
And I always say, lower your expectations when I speak.
I give it, you know, I'll...
Don't put me up on this pedestal.
I'm telling you, bro, she's very knowledgeable. Like, I give it to you raw, you know, and I have a way to sometimes not sell, but... I'm intriguing, I guess, in my talk and passionate.
Mm-hmm.
Jada is articulate, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, we're here. So I know Earn. I was introduced to Earn. I first found out about Earn through one of my buddies, Rags.
Okay.
They were having an art show at the next door to the Blacks and Wax Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped by, and me and my boy Rags, we went to middle school together, and he paints, and you know I paint. Mm-hmm. I have like a Basquiat-ish, if that's a word, type of
if it's not,
type of genre to my painting where I don't have to be as technical. I can just express myself, you know, and people were like, oh, wow, this looks magnificent, you know, at least I hope. And so me and Rags, we just, I came by to check some of his work out, and we just got the building, and I, that's when I first seen Earn, and I just, Earn had like, you know, Earn is a superstar. So Earn had the whole top floor of the gallery, everybody else is downstairs. So I went by to check it out, and I was like, man, this dude got some dope stuff. So nothing really came from that, and then we were planning the grand opening, and I would see Earn out and about, hear about some of the different stuff he had going on. I was like, man, I need to connect with him. We had the grand opening, and I was like, man, this would be the perfect time. Let's have an art show. Being that we're moving our office to North and Howard, mm-hmm. in the middle of like the art district in Baltimore, and we want to use our art to tell a story and to express what's happening in the urban environment, and basically let us know. The goal was to, here's how we, first I went into it with, here's what's happening in the urban environment, and here's some of the deficiencies, and BTST can be a resource to help offset some of those things. And then after I talked to Earn, he was like, no, we need to control the narrative. Everything is not bad in Baltimore.
Oh my gosh.
It's not bad in the urban community.
Say it again.
So we're going to highlight.
I say it all the time.
We're
going to
highlight the stuff that's happening here. And I was like, you know what? That's perfect. Let's go through it with a strength-based perspective.
We can't continue to let the story be so one-sided.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? We got to do justice to both sides of that.
Yeah. So then we got the building, and from there, you know, I found out that Earn was a NFL player, Penn State graduate. I'm giving his resume away, but as I like to say, nobody can speak about yourself as well as you can. If you're anything like Jada, you can't speak about yourself better than, nobody can speak about you better than you can. So hop on in and tell people who you are, give them some little background information and all that other stuff.
All right, so I mean, you gave a lot of the specifics, the bullet points, you know. I'm from Baltimore, you know, born and raised on the West Side. Went to high school outside of the city in Howard County. Went to Mount Hebron High before going away to college at Penn State University. There I majored in.
He didn't go to HBCU. He's blessed.
I was trying not to judge, but
Nah, man. I mean, I actually had.
He got a good old education.
The funny thing is, we actually have. I had that conversation with a lot of people, though. The irony in all that is, you know, the main reason that I went to Penn State, you know, obviously I was recruited by, you know, schools across the country.
Was Coach Paterno there then?
Yeah. I was the last group that he won a major bowl game with.
Did you know George, did you go to Penn State?
Oh, word. Man campus? Crazy. Were we there at the same time? It's hard to pinpoint his age, so I can't.
George is outstanding engineer for the day. Mike and Renato both are out, so GT is holding it down for us.
But nah, so like, you know, I definitely had a crazy experience, you know, in college there, you know, but sports was really what brought me, you know, to that type of school, you know. Had I not gone to Penn State, had I not been an athlete, I definitely would have been at an HBCU.
Sure.
And now that I'm in this space where, you know, I'm in addition to me being an artist and all that kind of stuff, I'm also an educator. Being so involved in the community now and everything that I do, you know, from a grassroots standpoint and as an educator, I'm actually giving thought to going back and doing some more, you know, getting some more college experiences.
Well,
you know
I'm the president of the Morgan State School of Social.
I'm in talks with some guys, man. Like we're thinking long term, but you know, obviously with my schedule and everything that I got going on, I got to make sure that, you know, that's
Morgan State University offer online classes as well.
Yeah, most definitely. I'm definitely not making any excuses. You're definitely gonna see. You're going to see me do some stuff in the next couple years. You know, I'm putting my plans together, but, you know, I definitely think that we all, as black people and, you know, just as people in general, you know, we got to do everything that we can to show the importance of education. And I think that when you personally are, you know, going out of your way to continue to better yourself, continue to equip yourself to know what you're doing in the community and to know how we're educating our children, I think that, you know, it'll help us as a whole.
So as a person who's born and raised in Baltimore and then educated at Penn State, what's the juxtaposition? What do you see? What are the differences? Were there contrasts that helped, that influenced your art?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, it was a bit of a culture shock, but mm-hmm. I think that what eased the transition was the fact that I had gone to high school in Howard mm-hmm. County, you know, because with that is a predominantly,
in the suburbs.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. a predominantly white, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Upper middle class mm-hmm. demographic of students that, you know, I was going to school with. So that for me was a bigger culture shock. You know, going from Baltimore City public school system sure. to the Howard County public school system was mm-hmm. a bigger culture shock than going from there to Penn State. It's almost like I went to college with a bunch of the people I went to high school with.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So you were already familiar with code switching.
Yeah. And that, you know, it did a lot to prepare me for the space that I was in mm-hmm. once I was in college, and even, you know, into the pros, you know what I'm saying? You mm-hmm. have to know how to relate to people that you don't share, a background with, and you don't share cultural experiences with, you know what I mean? I think that was the beginning of what started to open up my perspective mm-hmm. and I think that's part of what allows me to connect with so many people that I don't share certain experiences with, and I don't share certain cultural experiences sure. with, but I have an understanding for the fact that their experiences are just as important as mine. Their perspective is just as important as mine. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to be able to get them to understand my perspective, then we got to be able to have real dialogue, and mm-hmm. that takes connection.
Definitely. So we know that there's a lot of talent in Baltimore, but a lot of times people move their, when the talented people move their talents outside of Baltimore, right, and right. take them outside of Baltimore. What made you return?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to kill that. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? The whole idea that we as a people have, that we tend to equate success mm-hmm. with getting money, getting, you know, resources, getting Absolutely. Opportunities mm-hmm. and moving out the hood, you
yeah.
know what I mean, getting
yep.
out. But I just think that that's a backwards way of thinking. I've always hated that concept, because mm-hmm. who are we expecting to fix the hood for us?
It's,
you know,
social,
what I mean? Who
yeah,
are we
it's social stratification. It's social stratification. So exactly. if all of the talent and the resources move outside, who's yeah. left to fix?
And at the same time, those are mostly the same people that that go out of their way to kind of point out where our people are messing up.
Definitely.
But it's like,
so.
are you really being a part of the solution? Mm-hmm. Or are you just another person with a finger pointing?
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? Like, are you opening up businesses and hiring people and giving them a blueprint to success the mm-hmm. same way that you had to have? Or are we being selfish with those connections? Are we being selfish with those blessings? And you know, are we actually being a part of the problem?
So I know Aaron for a fact that he's not lying about this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh no.
No, and
I've always lived in Baltimore.
He's invited me over to his house uh-huh. when we were doing the filming for the grand opening part, and he does live not too far from, I don't know if you grew up there, but in the neighborhood, in mm-hmm. some of the neighborhoods not too far from here. Mm-hmm. And then I know him and one of my other buddies host a cookout in a little summer camp in, what is it, White Lock. Right up in White.
Shout out to the Stokey Project.
Yeah,
shout out Sioux City.
Yeah.
Shout out all the real ones doing work in the community.
So they're literally in the community. I happen to come by. Yeah, Stokey's my guy. Aaron's my guy. And, you know, I always have a passion for just giving back and being mm-hmm. involved. And everything Aaron said, and he patronizes the restaurants in mm-hmm. in these neighborhoods. When you think of an NFL player sometimes, mm-hmm. ex-NFL player, you think of glams, glitz, lights, bright lights, showy. And not saying Aaron isn't, you know, classy or anything like that, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? But when I see Aaron, I saw him like, hey, bro, you ready to roll? We're leaving here. And he's like, yeah, I'm just going to take the walk. I'm going to walk right up here and walk through and check some things out. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, he's about to walk from here to there. You know, most NFL players, that would have been beneath somebody.
But why is Aaron beneath him?
He's mm-hmm. really a missionary or a advocate for the community, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? And that's one thing that I really connected with Aaron on. And then we also shared the love for photography. So mm-hmm. not only is Aaron a painter, he's a poet. So he writes poetry, he writes essays, and then he also shoots. Mm. So me and him connected on like some camera stuff as well. We were just in here just going through some different settings and stuff, and his work is phenomenal. Work is phenomenal to the point, Jaden, you're going to be wild about this. So a kid from Baltimore, from an urban environment that probably most wouldn't have thought would have went to Penn State, had an art gallery, mm-hmm. an installation at Penn State. Mm. Most recently, talk about that, Aaron.
Man, that was crazy. That was in April, and it was supposed to be like 1 month, but it ended up being like they ended up extending it like for an extra month. But I didn't expect that. I didn't see that coming. You know what I mean? Because when you think of a school like Penn State University, you know, with respect, it's one of the whitest, most most conservative universities, you know, out there. So,
is it really that conservative?
Yeah, most definitely. Okay. You know what I mean? I think that we would like to think that our education system is liberal, but you know, my experience is that it's really a pretty conservative mm-hmm. Environment that that our students are educated in. And I think that contributes to how we're so siloed as a community, mm-hmm. you know, not just black people, but everybody. We mm-hmm. all live in our bubbles. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's because, you know, even from an educational standpoint, we're kind of driven in that direction. We're not supposed to make people uncomfortable.
Very true.
You know what I mean? We're mm-hmm. not supposed to have hard conversations. Mm-hmm. We're not supposed to really.
And so having your artwork on campus.
Yeah, and it was like a black. It was a Black Lives Matter. Like you can't overlook that part. It was a Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. show. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like
in
like
the middle of Penn State.
In the middle of Penn State, mm-hmm. like and like it's at the student center that mm-hmm. like every student has to walk into. So even if you don't actually walk into the gallery, the way the windows and all that kind of stuff are, you had to be confronted with that work. You know what I mean?
What was the response?
It was crazy, man. I went up there twice. I went up there in the beginning when we first opened, and you know, we did some interviews, and I talked to a lot of the students that were out, and it had been a while since I had been on campus, so the people up there that I'm still connected with, you know, spent some time with them. But I really wanted to included the students in the exhibition. So there was a back room that we had, and in that back room, one of the walls was a wall of questions. Mm-hmm. And it was just a wall of tough questions that was meant to force, you know, dialogue about a lot of these issues. Mm-hmm. And on the wall was all of these questions, and there was a table in front of the wall that had just paper and pens. Mm-hmm. And it just said, you know, answer what you feel. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, so there was conversation created from that. And then there was a back room that we had taken all of the students' protest signs mm-hmm. from different protests that they had staged on campus. Like, it was a die-in that they had did after Eric Garner's death. It was a protest that they did after Freddie Gray. It was a protest after who was it? Trayvon Martin. There was a whole bunch of different actions that students had taken on campus. So I wanted to highlight their activism. So we got a hold of as many of the signs that they mm-hmm. use as possible, and we suspended them all from like the ceiling. So it was kind of like a gallery of signs where you had to like kind of walk through that confronted, you know, patriarchy, racism, mm-hmm. Classism. Mm-hmm. You know, it really forced a lot of those hard discussions that we try to run away from. So as an artist, you know, just for Penn State reaching out to me to, you know, to be the vehicle by which those conversations took place was definitely a humbling experience. And it let me know that I'm on the right track with where I'm trying to go, because mm-hmm. truthfully, I think that art is a major part of the educational process. As an educator, I use my art to teach my students. You know what I mean? And I think that especially from a college level perspective, art is definitely something that you could teach a class on art activism. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you could teach a class on how we use our platforms to have dialogue on certain issues that make people uncomfortable. And I think that when a college jumps out there and is that bold and gives a person that opportunity, it shows that there's validity in that belief.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, particularly addressing education, because one of your pieces that evoked the response in me, and I don't know if this was your intention, but to me it spoke to the school to prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. And it was the one where it was a bunch of kids getting on, getting off of a yellow school bus, mm-hmm. and going to jails. And it struck me, and I saw this when it was at the art show that we had.
I know exactly what you're talking
and
about.
And so let me tell you how much it mattered to me. It struck me so much that I have a 9-year-old son, and I've always focused on his education, but that made me even more intense about it. Mm-hmm. It made me to really mm-hmm. make sure that we're studying with him and we're doing the things and really, really, truly involved in his education. Because when I saw that, it really hit home.
Yeah.
That's what happens. And we work a lot in the community and see that a lot, that a lot of the high schools that we have in the city are holding cells mm-hmm. for these. It's just a place, it's a holding pen until they graduate or age out or whatever it is for them to then do what?
Yeah,
can you talk to
I have so many conversations with people, and oftentimes it'll end up being on like a panel or at mm-hmm. a speaking engagement yeah. or somewhere where I'm sitting with some of our elders or some people that are also working in the community. And a lot of the times you'll get that narrative of, oh, our kids are lost. We're losing a generation.
You
know,
find
they're so mm-hmm. you know, they're so different than how we came up. Mm-hmm. You know, they have no respect. They this and that. And my simple response in every one of these situations is, well, who raised them?
Exactly.
Whose fault is that?
Mm-hmm.
How long are we going to victim blame in this mm-hmm. society and make criminals out of our own children before mm-hmm. society even gets a chance to, mm-hmm. you know? And like y'all are talking from a high school level. I teach elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm talking about pre-K through fifth.
Mm-hmm.
Our kids are walking into school burdened with trauma, burdened with burdened with poverty, mm-hmm. burdened with economic disenfranchisement that their parents suffer from and they don't even realize what it is yet.
Mm-hmm.
Burdened with society's expectations of who they're supposed to be and what's supposed to be expected out of them. So like knowing that, There's nothing that I can say and offer as an alternative other than education.
Mm-hmm.
Because how else are we gonna equip them to deal with that? You know what I mean? Like especially
yeah.
when they're dealing with their own elders, their own parents, their mm-hmm. own people and their own neighbors in their own communities that are labeling them the same way that society always has.
So Chris, they're not in here. You're not in the studio with us, but if you could be, you would understand that Aaron has this energy about him. It kind of makes you want to take to the streets and do something.
No,
seriously,
we need
does.
To. And
he
that's my thing.
Energy.
It's like,
you
like,
can feel it.
How
it's
long,
palpable.
How long are we just going, even
talk
having
about
this conversation
it.
Is like frustrating for me. So it's like, I had this conversation every day. How long
no.
are we going to keep
so
talking?
So can I say this?
You know what I mean? Like,
from a mental health perspective, what we oftentimes happens is when people come into therapy and come into treatment, we identify what the problems are.
Mm-hmm.
So we identify the problems. We talk about the history. We talk about all of the triggers. So if you think about it from that perspective, the question then becomes, now what?
Mm-hmm.
And so the next part that we take our clients to and we take our patients to is that we know what the problems are. So now let's work with some coping skills and some solutions so we can change the outcome.
Right.
So we want to disrupt the cycle. So what you're talking about on a social level is disrupting the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
going to take a multi-dimensional approach to do it, because there's not one person in one angle. And that, I think that's the part that brought us together mm-hmm. was that a way that we could, like with the BTSC Cares thing and how we're trying to offer these subsidized tutoring and use our fundraising and our resources to provide discounted services and resources to individuals. But the funny part about it is that both of you guys, Jada is a trauma certified therapist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she advocates for trauma and she's ready to talk about trauma at any given moment. And one of our first conversations was
about trauma.
About the undiagnosed trauma that happens,
mm-hmm.
about the PTSD that happens in these urban communities, how people become desensitized to killings,
that we don't
to
talk
shootings,
about.
And mm-hmm. that we don't talk about. And one of the traumas that stuck home with me was that how it's so traumatic that we can't even tell each other, another brother, that I love you.
Mm-hmm.
How that's been taken out of vocabulary or seen as a mm-hmm. sign of weakness.
Like, it's crazy, man. And I used to think that it was just an issue with us as black men.
Mm-mm.
You know what I mean? Like, I thought that was a thing just because, you know, we all know the story. You know, we're growing up, we're told, you know what I mean, you're not supposed to cry. You know what I'm saying? You're not supposed to whine. You're not supposed to complain. You're supposed to tough it out. You're supposed to figure it out. You know, so those are things that we grow up groomed with. Mm-hmm. And you think that when you get older, you're suffering from the residual effects of just that. But it's not just us. Mm-hmm. Like my kids that I talk about, my students, my own children, I watch how it's easier for them to make fun of one another, mm-hmm. or to insult one another than it is for them to pay each other a genuine compliment.
Yeah.
Or for them to ask for help when they need it.
The disconnect.
Or for them to admit that mm-hmm. they're struggling with something. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, the roots of this stuff go deep, man. Mm-hmm. And it's like, in order for us to disrupt that, as you said, mm-hmm. we got to remove that stigma completely. Like, we have to be the ones, the adults, we have to be the ones to change that. So if I continue to dwell in that space where, you know, I'm always good, you know what I mean? I don't struggle with anything. Mm-hmm. You know, everything's always straight, regardless of how bad it is. Mm-hmm. I'm going to figure it out. Nah, man.
Yep.
Let's get past
that. Acknowledge your feelings.
We can't heal. Mm-hmm. We can't heal. We cannot heal until we at least can admit that we're in pain.
All right.
And we got so many of our people that are suffering in silence. And, you know, that's why I think it's so important what you guys are doing, because, yo, how many methadone clinics are we going to put up and act like that's really doing the job?
It's going to be the
You know
fix,
what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, how long are we going to continue to put Band-Aids on shotgun hemorrhage wounds? You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Like, how long are we going to continue to act like, you know, these things that we're living through are normal when they're not? You know, we've normalized.
It's
we've
like
normalized
that thing you can't
behaviors
tell.
That should never be normalized, and we've normalized suffering that nobody should feel
why
like
is that
practical.
Though? Why do you? Why is it that
because what was
we
our
can't
alternative?
Talk about our issue? We it's almost like when in the urban community, if you want to talk about your issue, it's like get over it, whatever. Like you can't, you shouldn't discuss this stuff. But you know, I see some of my counterparts, like some of my buddies that. Like some of my Jewish counterparts, mm-hmm. it's okay to talk about their history and what happened and the unfortunate situation that happened with them, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But when we want to talk about slavery, it's like, oh, that's years ago. And then we want to talk about
that. I'm not going to trivialize the struggle of Jewish people all
over
the world.
Yeah.
But the difference between us and them right now is we're still dealing with those residual effects of our genocide. You know what I mean? Like from an economic, mental, and spiritual perspective. You know what I'm saying? Like when I talk about, yo, slavery was the most diabolical thing ever to happen, it's like people want to move past it. But how do you tell a rape victim to move past rape? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
How do you tell a victim of abuse, you know what I mean, to move past their trauma without addressing it? How do you tell a victim of any heinous crime just to move on? Slavery was one of the only things that really included every single one of those categories. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, our ancestors were raped, beaten, separated mm-hmm. from their families. You know what I mean? Like, our ancestors were turned against one another, you know, and we're still dealing with residual effects of that. By the way that we deal with issues of colorism in our own community, by the way we deal with issues of misogyny in our own community.
Definitely, yes.
You know, like, that wasn't us. Mm-hmm. That was literally, like, and the proof is out here at this point. If you care to read a book, you can learn how that was a planned...
The Willie Lynch story.
Yeah, that was a planned action. And we're still, at this point, dealing with the residual effects of these things. And in order to move past something that diabolical, you got to have a complete shift in culture. Mm. You know what I mean? We as a people, before we go to our officials, our public officials and all that kind of stuff, there's a lot of things that we got to be able to get right with ourselves and in our own community.
So you're saying the mindset, the way we think about ourselves,
has
to change.
Of course. The way we think about ourselves and the way that we deal with one another. Because mm-hmm. the same way we can talk about different cultures and things that they've experienced and how they've been able to move past it. How did they get past it?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? We were just talking about that idea of moving out of the hood,
mm-hmm.
right? How many people when I had these conversations with people, I'll hear a lot of people say, well, who wants to open up a store on North Avenue? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Where you got to put on your body armor. Who wants to open up a store down the hill? Who wants to? And my answer is, everybody but us, apparently.
Exactly.
Because when I go into the liquor store, Asian man owns it. Yeah. When I go into the bodega, a Hindu man owns it. Mm-hmm. When I go into, you know what I'm saying, like the little shop where the kids get their candy and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's a Jewish brother.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, so all of these people, all of these cultures that don't share any of the shared experiences that we have, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Look right past all of those issues and see the importance of investing, mm-hmm. because they know, where else we gonna go?
So Aaron, is that,
where else we gonna
when
go?
You I'm, gonna say
the,
this.
I'm gonna take 2-3 buses yeah. to go to the liquor store that a black man owns down. No. So if we opened up these businesses, if we did build within our community,
mm-hmm.
we will see a change.
When I hear you speak, I always have this therapist hat on. And so when I hear you speak, I think about families who've experienced trauma, and you'll have people who will try to distance themselves from the family. But the problem is, you never forget the mm-hmm. family. So you can build up a wall, you can cut off contact, but they're always there in the back of your mind, and your heart is always tugged by that. And I feel like that's what's happening with our communities, mm-hmm. is that we realize that we have to resolve the family issue first before we can then move on.
And there's no escape.
No escape.
You know what I mean?
You
like
can't. Yeah.
You can run to the suburbs if you want, but you're gonna learn real quick, like I did when I was in high school, they never wanted us out there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So you can move out if you want.
Yeah.
You still gonna be one of us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
like
no,
you still not gonna be looked at
mm-hmm.
as a white man or a white woman, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? You're still not going to be looked at as what you're surrounding yourself with. So at mm-hmm. the end of the day, where does this desire, like, I feel like for a certain point in time, we've just equated everything white with being everything that is good for black people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that everything white is bad and all that kind of stuff. No, but I mm-hmm. feel like when you have such a desire to assimilate into somebody else's culture,
mm-hmm.
it takes away from your own self-awareness and your own ability to be prideful in where you come from.
Do you think,
you know,
this is
what
part
made
of
us so ashamed?
Mm-hmm.
What made us so ashamed of being from where we're from?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, because the way I see it, what other people could have survived
mm-hmm.
what we've made it through?
You know, I always, I mean, say, like, that there's, like, pride in the fact that our ancestors were able to survive the Middle Passage. And when you read and you do research and resiliency and chattel slavery and Jim Crow and segregation and the crack epidemic of the 80s and the heroin epidemics of the 90s. And
I thought the opium epidemic just started.
Oh, I forgot.
It just got out to the county.
It just became, you know, but
no,
you have
but
to think, and we're still here.
But how crazy is it that now we want to talk about mental health? You know what I mean? Now we want to talk about medicating trauma with pain. I mean, trauma with trauma.
Yeah.
Now we want to talk about prescription drugs. Now we want to have this discussion.
Yeah.
Where was that discussion for our fathers and mothers and grandmothers? You know, I know 3 generations of dope fiends. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I write about it in the book where I talk about, you know, I've seen sons and daughters of drug abuse that became drug abusers. You know what I mean? Like, I've seen, like, products of abusive households that
mm-hmm.
became abusive people.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I've seen products of this trauma and pain that we talk about. And because it was never healed, we just continue to perpetuate the same issues. You know what I'm saying? There was never that shift in culture.
So, you know, one of the things that I've took a personal responsibility of doing, one, I always see, like, when somebody could do something great, right? And us as individuals, some of the first response was like, oh, well, they ain't do it like that, or they ain't to that level, before we even turn to commend somebody for whatever level of accomplishment
it's
or whatever
to break
happens,
us down
it's
to build
always
us up.
Easy to find
mm-hmm.
something wrong. So, and you've been trained, I find myself be like, oh, well, and then I gotta stop myself, like, that's great, you know what I mean? That's great. Hey, here's an idea I have that could possibly help you with doing something better. You know what I mean? Another thing that I've done was also, like you said, a lot of people don't like to talk about what we're going through. You know what I mean? So we all live in this made-up world where everybody's great, everybody's functional. I found that I start talking about some of my vulnerabilities and just some of the stuff that I go through. And I'm not trying to create this perfect picture on Instagram and social media and all this other stuff. I, like, when I found that, I start talking about that my wife and I, even together, still go to marriage counseling, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And because we work through stuff.
Yeah.
People, the response that I've gotten was like, wow, I wish more people would just actually talk about these things. Because mm-hmm. once you talk about it, it lets it know that these things are normal. And then once it's normal, then now we can work together to try to change the perspective on these things and how to figure these things out.
Yeah.
One of the things that I heard you talk about after the Freddie Gray situation was our need to control the narrative. Because some people could say, wow, this dude, Aaron, just talks about the as a dark person. He just have a dark perception on things, and it's a negative reality. But when we were talking, and I know you, and I know the way you see things and the strengths you see in our communities, it's a beautiful place. Even all the negative stuff that we've just discussed, or not negative, but some of the harsh parts that we just discussed, there's beauty within our people,
so much
and beauty within
struggle.
Our communities.
Yeah, yeah.
So talk about the need for us to need to control the narrative, and then we're going to transition to how you starting to control the narrative as well.
I mean, I just think it's paramount that we control the narrative, because if we don't, then who does? Who controls our narrative right now? Mm-hmm. It ain't us.
Definitely so.
You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. when I travel around the world and people hear that I'm from Baltimore, they don't talk about the city that I know.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? They talk about what they see on television. They talk about what they've, you know, seen on the wire. They talk about what they've seen on the news, you know, after the uprising, you know. So my thing is, the same amount of energy that we put into talking about the negative aspects of our city, we have to put into talking about how beautiful we still are in spite of that struggle. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's what's made us so great. You know, that's what's made, without the struggle, this book doesn't even exist.
Mm-hmm.
None of the artwork that's created, you know, out of that struggle mm-hmm. exists. You know, none of those experiences, it's like, yeah, we've been fighting for a long time,
mm-hmm.
but that fight, during that fight, our knuckles got sharp. You know what I mean? Like, sure. And during that fight, our mental, you know what I mean? It was different. Our mentality mm-hmm. was different. So when I talk to somebody that comes from where I come from, you know, that's lived through some of the things that I've lived through, I know that there's not just a strong person sitting in front of me. There's a creative person sitting in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They used to turn milk crates into basketball hoops, making mm-hmm. way for our first hoop drains in mm-hmm. the back alleyways. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they used to build wagons out of all the discarded wood.
With
they
the
used
wood,
to be
yeah.
like, yeah, like, but like, who else has these stories?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, yo, there was a whole, what I talk about sometimes is, it's like, the thing about gentrification is people will act like, you know, it's a win when you tear down a project,
yes. mm-hmm.
or when you tear down a community of poor people and abandoned homes and things like that. But what you don't realize is you destroy the cultural context of that neighborhood. What you don't realize is Miss May down at apartment 7B used to watch everybody in the complex's kids. You know what I mean? Like, because they couldn't afford to take them to the daycare down the street that was too expensive. You know what I'm saying? Miss Monica upstairs used to do everybody's hair. You know what I mean? Like Mr. Tyrone down the street, he would fix everybody's car. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? For the low.
Mm-hmm.
He got tires, all that. You know, but when you relocate these people, you also destroy that sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
You destroy
the fabric of the community.
The fabric of the community mm-hmm. that allowed those people to stay afloat.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And when you don't acknowledge the beauty in us making do with whatever we have,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? Like, when you don't got money, when you don't have food, but you still got a house full of people with smiles on their faces. You know what I mean? Spending time with each other, you know, building the type of things that money can't buy.
Mm.
So speaking of something that money can buy, I got this. I have this book in front of me, and the need to control the narrative. And we had this conversation after the Freddie Gray. All the cameras came in and was just showing all the ill parts of Baltimore. And it was like, I know that really drove you nuts. People mm-hmm. that ain't never been to Baltimore found out where North Avenue and Monroe or North Avenue and Fulton was. It was like, I'm going there, and this is what I'm going to show.
Mm-hmm.
But you've combated that by this book that's sitting in front of me called Art Activism, which highlights and has, I briefly got to look through some of it, man, and it's phenomenal. It has,
I appreciate it, bro.
Some of your artwork that sells for thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars here in the pages,
mm-hmm.
mixed in with your poetry,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
mixed in with your essays. Talk to me about the book and what is it? What is art activism? Sorry.
Well, at the end of the day, I just feel as though every human being, whether you want to acknowledge it or not, is an activist in some way. You know what I mean? We argue every day trying to persuade.
We argue? We argue?
We argue with people every day.
Do we? Do I argue?
We argue with people every day.
I'm no comment.
If somebody has a different
You want to start arguing now?
I don't want to start an argument. I don't argue,
so we ain't going to argue.
If we talk politics long enough, one of us will have something that we disagree about,
mm-hmm.
and we'll try to convince each other to see things from our perspective.
Yeah.
If we talking basketball, you know what I mean? We talking football. If we talking anything that we could possibly be talking about, we advocate for ourselves.
So
right?
Like when I tell you Jay-Z is the best rapper, what you going to say?
I appreciate your perspective.
So now I want to know who you believe the resurrected.
No, like I don't believe there is a best rapper.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. I appreciate different things about different artists. Or artists like Jay-Z, I appreciate his growth. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I appreciate that a guy from Marcy Projects, you know what I mean, that made money.
Man, I'm trying to start an argument. I'm not trying to believe like a rapper. I'm trying to argue. But no, go ahead.
But that's
talk
the
about
thing. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. you know, we don't shy away from arguments when it's stuff that we're comfortable having discourse about.
Mm-hmm.
But the things that are uncomfortable, things like confronting racism, things like confronting patriarchy, things like confronting a lot of the self-hate that a lot of us still carry, mm-hmm. and how we manifest that in our relationships with other people, we kind of tuck tail and run.
Mm.
You know, we don't want to offend, or we don't want to, you know, seem like the angry black one or all that kind of stuff. But I think that we're at a position now where we can no longer afford to stand on the sidelines with certain issues. And regardless of what you are, whether you're an artist, whether you're an athlete, whether you're a corporate employee, whatever it is, we got to use whatever our platform is to shed light on what's going on, but also talk about that next step. What do we do now? You know what I mean? Going forward, what's the plan? Mm-hmm. How do we rectify these issues, and how do we heal? You know, and I think that art activism, you know, it's my platform that I use. You know what I'm saying? It's my work. You know, if you look at anything that I do, pretty much, you know, I try not to dedicate any of my time or energy to anything that doesn't build, that doesn't, you know, improve my life of my children or the life of my people in some way. You know what I mean? And I think that we all have to start thinking about how we use our platforms in that way, whether you're a rapper, whether you're an actor, whether you're an artist, entertainer, whatever. Like, are you doing the best you can? You know what I mean? Not just to help us out, to create jobs or all that, but to provide an example of what we should be doing, how we
excellence.
Are we holding each other accountable? And I think that the biggest thing is I'm very belligerent about this. You will never see me publicly condemn another black man or woman that's doing work. You know what I mean? That's doing good work. Whether I disagree with you or not, we can disagree all day. But are you doing work that needs to get done? If you are, I'm not going to publicly say anything against you. What I will do, though, if I disagree with something that you're doing, we're going to have a conversation, and I'm going to hold you accountable in that conversation. But I feel like as a people, we need to present a united front, because we spend so much time. Man, you can work in the exact same field.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than sitting down, having a conversation and saying, how do we build?
Yeah,
I would tell people, hey, look, this dude Chris, he ain't really doing it for the right reasons.
That's
he,
so true.
He's this, he's mm-hmm. that. Yo, bro, where does that get us?
Mm-hmm. After the grand,
so true.
After the That's grand so true. Opening, we got, some people said, oh, they just take advantage of low-income families and neighborhoods, this, that, and the third. And I'm like, or like, you just taking advantage of them and you just taking out of these communities. I'm like, do y'all know not just the cost to put this here,
mm-hmm.
this was an this is not me taking out. This is an investment in, from me into the community to make this place as nice as it is. Mm-hmm. But you don't have the same argument when Right Time Medical opens up right in the middle of your, and you don't know the owner of them. Mm-hmm. But being that I'm the, being that, you know what I mean, I'm trying to make myself accessible to you and show you what's possible and do this for the people, you now find a way, a reason to change what the reason for this is, you know what I mean?
But anything that disrupts the natural order of things, anything that makes people uncomfortable is going to bring about that kind of reaction, man. Like, you know, real talk, bro, we can't even pay attention to that noise.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like yeah, you know, you can hear it, but it can't affect mm-hmm. not one aspect of what we do, because at the end of the day, this heavy lifting that we doing, it has to be from the understanding of, yo, I realistically probably won't see the change that I'm fighting for.
Wow.
But hopefully my kids will. Hopefully my kids' kids will. Hopefully the world that they grow up in is a little bit different. Hopefully the city that they grow up in is a little bit better, because people like me, people like you are, we're all committed mm-hmm. to making the hard decisions, to having the hard conversations.
And that's the part why we, one, use our platform to reach out and work with other organizations. We even have other organizations that we take under our wing, so, and try to provide some tutelage, because we want more people doing the same stuff that we're doing mm-hmm. in the same field. But then also, that was you can't do it all. And that's why
you don't have the capacity to deal with all of the people that are struggling exactly. with mental health in the city.
Exactly. Yeah,
you know what I mean? People, I don't have that
people
capacity.
Feel like they have together, to be there. A lot of people feel like they have to, they're the gatekeeper mm-hmm. or the information only belongs to them.
Look, man, these gatekeepers in the way. I'm not lying, man. I'm in at least 2 or 3 meetings every week with one of these quote unquote gatekeepers that, you know, has been in this patriarchal position of power for mm-hmm. way too long.
Yeah.
And their priorities ain't where they supposed to be anymore. Like, real talk, if you have a plug, if you have knowledge, if you have information, if you have a resource that can help people mm-hmm. and you holding it back.
Yeah.
Yo, like Uncle Tom, Coon, Sellout, that's too nice mm-hmm. for a person like that, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because it's like, we literally cannot afford that.
We need all hands on deck.
Like,
knock on wood.
we need all hands on mm-hmm. deck. We need our people on the front lines. So I'm talking like from the schools all the way up to the political office. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And we're dealing with one of the most uneducated electorates ever in the history of this country. Mm-hmm. Politically, like socially, like we don't even teach civics anymore in school. You know what I mean? Like I have to sneak civics into my lesson plans because I know the kids aren't going to get it in their mm-hmm. other classes. You know, you got to sneak stuff. Like we have to get uncomfortable with how we engage each other. We have to, like, the fact of the matter is, change never came, has never come about in this country or anywhere in this world. When people have been allowed to be comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what everybody wants from us. Everybody wants, even when you look at what's happening like in the NFL with, you know, the guys that are choosing to take a knee and all that kind of stuff. Like, the issue isn't, you haven't seen one owner say that the issues that they're talking about aren't real. You've seen them deflect. Mm-hmm. You've seen them try to make it about the troops and about the flag. But none of these people are going to actually go out there and say what's happening to us is cool. You know what I mean? But what are they doing? You know what I mean? Like where's the aid coming from? Like, where's the, we can talk about breast cancer awareness. We can talk about, you know what I mean? Spousal abuse. We can talk about all these different things. But the issue is we want to be able to do it in a way that's comfortable.
Mm. So
if you want to do something, then do it on your own time where nobody will see it and nobody will write about it and nobody will talk about it. And that'll make things better. No, it won't. Because players have foundations for years. Mm. You know, people have been doing, all the people that are saying, yo, why don't they just do this? They have no idea that these players have been doing all these things for years, but nobody cares until it's shoved right in front of your face and say, all right, this is what we're dealing with.
So this is one thing that, I love your passion.
I keep saying the energy this. Is crazy.
Bro, we could talk. We could have this conversation for like 6 podcasts. This year. But I want to, I don't want to like not talk about that. But you have such a great thing going on right now that I want to put the focus on some of this as well. Because what we like to do at BTST is have, we started this podcast so that we can discuss these things. Mm-hmm. That we can feature other services that are going well. People that have creative ideas on these things. People who have been able to find a void in the community and are doing things to fix it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we are trying to use our voices and our platforms as another use this as another creative way to get the message out, to start these conversations. And I want to start the conversation about this art activism thing. Is this your first book?
Yes. Yes.
What was the experience like in writing the book? Because not only do I want to cover the content, but I want your story and what happened for you to maybe be like, wow, I can write a book if Aaron wrote one.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all need, everybody need to be working on something. You know what I mean? Like, we all have a story to tell. Like, I say that in, you know, the artist statement, you know, before the book even kicks off. Like, you know, all of us have a story to tell, but art is my vehicle by which I bring those stories to the world. You know what I mean? So whether it's a visual story, whether it's a literal story, you know, I'm telling stories, you know what I mean? Like stories of
true
people.
Stories.
Yeah, true stories of people that don't get their stories told, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Because the news don't care, you know what I mean? Like the writers and the journalists don't care. So I think that as an artist, you know, and I do journalism. I've written some stuff for The Sun and The
what
Post and stuff
do,
like
yeah.
that. I mean, yo, you can't put me in a box, man.
Yeah.
You know, when I was an athlete, people tried to say, yeah, just stick to sports. But like, nah, I was never just an athlete. I was never just an artist.
None of us are just one thing.
I'm all these things. Yeah.
So in the book,
Get you somebody who can do both.
he's putting his personal ad out right now, ladies.
Nah,
I'm just kidding. I'm just messing around.
I don't want no trouble.
So in the beginning of the book, there's this image of this guy who looks a little younger, who has hair a little shorter. And then towards the end of the book, I see this other guy who has a lot longer hair, who seems like he knows what he's here for and what he's about, what he's trying to do. And I actually thought they were two different people at once.
It looked like
they're
two
both
different
you.
People almost.
It's almost like when Obama came in office, jet black hair, and then he's going out of office a blonde.
Sure. I had to black it out so you wouldn't see the grays I got.
Yeah. So talk about what was the process like? Did you get discouraged throughout this process?
Nah, man. I mean, I spent... Book,
how long did
book,
it take?
I've been working on the book for like 2 years. Okay. You know what I mean? Like, and I think that was, if anything, that was the ironic part of that process. You know, the fact that I kind of really started working on it not with the intent of writing a book specifically, but I just started writing more and more and more. And it was more so about the whole narrative piece. It started off with a few op-eds that I did for the Baltimore Sun. And I always write poetry. You know, I carry, you know, everywhere I go, I got at least 2-3 notebooks on me.
That is true.
You know, I'm either sketching little ideas in or I'm writing a bar here or mm-hmm. a stanza there or okay. something like that, you know, as I get it, because I don't want to lose the inspiration. And like, my mind's just a labyrinth of different creative ideas. So I just started pushing pen to the pad, man. And you know, throughout that process, I realized, you know, after the uprising, that there was a needed space for artistic content that told a unique perspective of that story. You know what I mean? Like, from a standpoint of the people, you know what I mean? From a standpoint of the underlying causes of, you know, what other people try to describe as a riot. You know, Martin Luther King called a riot the language of the unheard.
Mm.
So this book was my attempt to put a voice behind, you know what I mean, those faceless people that have been suffering for so long. So, you know, I didn't want to come off preachy. I didn't want it to seem like I was writing for an intellectual demographic. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to be able to walk down on North Avenue and just put this in somebody's hands, no matter how old they are or young,
mm-hmm.
and have them be able to read through it and really wrestle with some of the stuff in there.
So the book isn't like most books where it's just a whole bunch of paragraphs and just a storytelling. Nah, nah. It's basically your poems.
Yeah, it's got sketches and like I want even if you're not an avid reader, I want you to be able to get like I don't believe that a person exists that can't read. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like I see that when my students read this book. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? My elementary school students, I teach my class in the library, mm-hmm. right? So with my older students, when they come in the class, first 15 minutes of class, they pick their own book and they read for the first 10 minutes. And then we have a 5-minute conversation where I'm asking them critical thinking questions about what they've been reading. And every single class, without fail, they'll come in and 4 or 5 of them will crowd around my desk, be like, can I get the book? Because it was just at first I just had a proof copy.
Yeah.
It's in my bag right there. It's binded with a spiral binding and all that kind of stuff. But like, it speaks to them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because I'm not trying to talk down to them or anything like that. In a lot of different stanzas, like I keep it real short. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking language that they understand. You know, I'm meeting them where they're at.
Yeah, you
know
really what I mean?
And at the end of the day, I'm meeting them where they at. That's perfect for y'all. Like, but I think that the sketches that I have in the background of certain essays where it's more heavy lifting type mm-hmm. stuff will hopefully make them want to keep on reading because they see something in the artwork that says, well, let me see what these words have to say. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I want them to continuously be intrigued to keep turning pages, you know, because I feel as though if you ask certain questions, you know what I mean? Like, it's impossible for somebody not to start thinking about how you accomplish those things. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, when you ask people questions and make them wrestle with things that they haven't really thought about before, mm-hmm. I think that you begin to walk them down the path towards becoming a critical thinker. And
so when I went through your book, I noticed that it was more of an experience. I didn't necessarily feel like I was reading a book. I felt like I was experiencing something. You know what I mean? Yeah, I was having an experience.
I mean, I appreciate that. That's really what I want. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I want people to experience the book. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really unlike a lot of the books that even I've ever read. You know what I mean? Like I had, like with the woman that I work with to do the project. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Nakia Redman. But we really spent a long time wrestling with that part. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we combine all of these things that like are similar but really so different? You know, the artwork,
you
the poetry,
did it.
The
you did
sketches,
it.
The you know paintings. You know, these are. Mm-hmm. Some of the paintings are like huge paintings, like mm-hmm. the size of this wall. So how do you take something that big
and condense
try to
it?
Condense it, but still make the details like apparent for people to be able to like conceptualize. So I spent a lot of time wrestling with that because I do want this book to be something that people experience.
Felt like a commentary on the Black experience. You had civil rights leaders, you had references to slavery, you had common experiences between Black men and women now. Mm-hmm. There's a portrait of James Baldwin in there. And I mean, there's
fire
just-
Fire next time.
Yeah, the fire next time. There was just so much, there's things, it was almost like the complete, if the Black experience could be put into artistic form, it's almost like a complete commentary mm-hmm. on the Black experience from the Middle Passage until now. Mm-hmm. Not even just from the Middle Passage, from the creation of the universe until now.
Yeah.
So what did you spend hours in meditation and
I mean, you know,
and thought.
Art, prayer, meditation, all of these things are pretty much the same for me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. This book, I really wanted this book to be something that when people look through, they get the same feeling that I got the first time mm-hmm. I looked through Emery Douglas's work, you know what I mean? Or Larry mm-hmm. Poncho Brown's work, or mm-hmm. Charles Bibbs, you know? These are people that when I talk about the Black experience, when I talk about civil rights and all of these different issues, these people were basically the journalists, the artistic journalists of mm-hmm. their time. You know what I mean? Like when you look at all of the Black Panthers newspapers and all that kind of stuff, that was all Emery Douglas's mm-hmm. work. You know what I mean? When you think about back to In Living Color and the Bill Cosby show, like all the artwork that you would see, that's guys like Poncho and Charles Bibbs. So I,
that was going to be one of my questions. Who was one of your mentors? I know Poncho was.
Yeah. I had a lot of mentors, man. And I'm thankful to everybody that has sold into me as an artist. But, you know, Larry Poncho Brown would definitely be my biggest artistic mentor, mm-hmm. you know, from the age of about 4 or 5 years old.
Wow.
You know, I was in his studio, you mm-hmm. know, learning from him, and you know,
you were exposed really young.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And I think that he killed it in the foreword by, mm-hmm. you know, talking about how our relationship started. And you know, he ends the foreword off but pretty much saying that, you know, my work is a sledgehammer of integrity. Mm-hmm. And for your mentor, for your idol to yeah. say something like that about you is like, I'm like, all right, well, thanks for the quote, because that's going right on the back of the book. But it says a lot, I think, about, you know, the fact that I do feel like I accomplished what I tried to do, which mm-hmm. was to be real. If you notice, I'm not really in the book that much. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. like
you ain't all in the video.
I'm all in the videos. You know what I'm saying? Like, there will come a time where, like, you know, where I do a book about specifically my experiences and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. But it's not this project. Mm-hmm. I didn't want this to be something where, like, you read this and you're reading all about me. You're going to learn more about Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And you're going to learn more about life from the perspective of a black man.
I think it speaks to that. It speaks to what you referenced before about this shared experience. Because when I see this book, I see a lot of me in this book. I see a lot of you. Right. I see a lot of George over there. I see a lot of all of us, because it's the shared black experience is mm-hmm. what I see in the book and what you referenced earlier.
Yeah, and it's like, because a lot of the stories, as I said, aren't even my stories, but they're stories of people I know that never get told. You know what I'm saying? Like there's several pieces that I could probably, you know, turn to and say, like, all right, this or that had significant, you know what I mean, social impact and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it was one, Paul, let me see if I could find it. You know, this one, black history. History is exhausted. Tired of being erased, tired of being rewritten, tired of being repressed, tired of being suppressed. Well, I'll be damned. Mm-hmm. History is a black man. but in the beginning of the word, I put womb in front of it. So it's really a black woman. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the image, you know what I'm saying? Like mm-hmm. it coincides directly with that. But like a poem like this one, I talk about a young kid that me and Stokey mentor at our camp. You know what I'm saying? Like, the kid that is in the picture is actually the kid who is written about, and he's the kid that's sketched right here. You know wow. what I mean? So these are stories that aren't even necessarily mine, but they're stories that we all growing up in this city, I feel like, can relate to. You know what I'm saying? And mm-hmm. I'm not trying to paint myself as anything mm-hmm. in particular. You know, I'm not trying to stand up on a pedestal and, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, and be perceived as something I'm not, you know? And like this Hustler's Tales piece, like I've never sold dope. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But sure. at the end of the day, these are my friends. These are the people that I grew up with. These are the people who I still live around, because, as we said, I never moved away.
You never moved away.
So I don't look at them as, oh, the criminals. Or mm-hmm. I look at somebody that feels like they don't have any other options.
But it's, you know, so funny, because you are another option. Mm-hmm. So for all of these children, just like you said, you were influenced by your mentor at a young age. You're in the schools with the people who, with the children who live in the same neighborhoods as these hustlers. So while they may see that as an option, they also know that there's an Aaron Maidman option as well.
And I also know the hustlers.
Yeah.
You feel me?
Well, like, I'm from Baltimore, so I know the hustlers are also people.
And I'm not making it seem like the hustlers aren't.
It's
like,
not the faceless bad guys.
I feel like one of the biggest problems mm-hmm. in our community, right, mm-hmm. is we've bought into our own racism. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Because, like you said, it's the narrative that's controlled and pressed upon you.
They've mm-hmm. labeled so many of us as criminals before we have a chance to tell our side of the story. Mm-hmm. We're not forced to look at each other as people, even mm-hmm. as black people. You'll hear that somebody did a bid, that somebody did time, mm-hmm. and as soon as you hear that they did time, you'll be okay with them not being able to get a job, mm-hmm. or them not being able to get housing, or them not being able to have access to true freedom in this country. You know what I mean? Because it's like, yo, that's the decision that they made. They didn't have to do that.
Internalized depression. You know what I
mean? Mm-hmm. So does that make the situations that led them down that path right? Mm. You know what I mean? Does that make that acceptable? Mm. So our kids that are growing up, are we just basically holding their hands and walking them right down the same path? Mm-hmm. You know, so my thing is, it's like, unless I got a job to offer you, unless I have some kind of resource that I can bring, I can't condemn how you feeding your family. Mm. You know what I mean? Because I know out here it's a struggle, you know, and the fact that we don't talk about that struggle enough, we don't talk about how we're not creating a safety net for our people. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, we're allowing many of them to fall through those cracks.
Wow. So, Aaron, about your book, who's the publishing company?
This is a self-published project. I did this on purpose. I definitely, like, you know, I had some interest from some folks. You know what I mean? I took some meetings and all that kind of stuff. But the feeling that I left most of those meetings with was, I'm going to hand them a project and they just gonna chop up my shit. I'm sorry, I should cuss. I said I'm gonna hand them this project and they're gonna edit it. They're gonna edit it away. You know what I mean? They're gonna edit away the emotion. They're gonna edit away the passion. They're gonna edit away the cultural context and dialogue that only somebody from Baltimore would really understand. Because I'm all right with that. You know what I mean? If I read a book from Hebrew Brantley, right? I want the Chicago rhetoric to be in there. You know what I mean? I want the slang to be in there. I want it to be authentic to where he comes from. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I start the book with an open letter to Baltimore. You know what I mean? And I write to her as if she's a woman. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like I write to her as if, like, you know, I might need to get you to write something
so I can send my wife. Make me a romantic. Ern, can you say this for me in a nice way?
Yo, I do greeting cards. Personal sonnets, love notes, but I wanted this to be something that's authentic to who I am and where I come from, and Baltimore made me. You know what I mean? So
I have the draft here, right? Yeah. Is this what it's called, a draft?
It's a proof. It's a proof copy. So
when will the first ones be out and ready?
By Monday.
By Monday.
Wow. Yeah.
So where can people that are interested pick them up at?
Online, they'll be available online on Monday. I'm selling them through Amazon online, and I also have them on my website, aaronmaben.com. But I'll be launching the physical copies next week as well, and those will I'll have a couple meetings today, so I can't say exactly where I'm dropping them yet. But I'll have them in three locations here in Baltimore City for people to be able to buy.
Okay. I think I'm definitely going to buy one. Jada, I'm putting you on the spot.
I'm going to definitely.
We got to get one maybe for the library.
Yeah, definitely.
But Aaron, I actually want to even do something even bigger. I think that maybe we can have like a book signing and reading over in the multi-purpose room.
Yeah, I'm
coordinate
down.
Like a good event, have some people come out and allow you to, you know, do your thing.
Hey, I'm always open. I'm always open and down to do anything that leads to us being able to build.
I want other people to be able to experience this energy.
Yeah, I want them to see it live, like in person, get the passion, get mm-hmm. the banging on the desk. You know what I mean? Get the dreads flying through the air. You know what I mean? I want them to get that. I think that'd be great.
Yeah, he makes me want to say things I don't feel comfortable saying on air. But he wants us to be uncomfortable, right? Right?
I want us to be able to get uncomfortable.
I don't even think we need an on a couch section today.
No, not today. We can save that for another time.
Yeah, I think Aaron has me on
the couch. I'm tired. He wore me out.
I think we got enough therapy today. Yeah.
Yo, it was awesome. Thank you so much
for having me.
So, Aaron, anything else you want to leave with about the book, about what you got going on? Oh, so not only was he in Penn State, he also had one at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. Is that still going on?
The Reginald F. Lewis exhibit is still up, I believe, and I'm happy that it's still up, and they should be happy too. It was supposed to, that exhibit was only supposed to go for a month, right?
Uh-huh.
But because of the reception that it got from the people, they've extended it now for 2 months.
So, oh, really?
Like, I mean, like, I,
It was supposed to come down last week, but I seen people posting pictures in the exhibit.
So it's still going.
Yeah.
Because what I wanted to do was to take some of our clients. I called you one day, like, man, I need to bring some of our clients. Mm-hmm. And I kind of lost the energy or just got boggled down in life. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna work with Val to see if we can take some
it's
of our
been
clients
powerful,
down there.
Man, we took my kids on some field trips there over the summer. And
how much does it cost to get in?
My exhibit is free.
Oh, we definitely going.
If you want to tour,
we're definitely going now.
If you want to tour the whole building for kids,
now we don't need to see them, but we come to see Earn.
For kids, it's like $2.
Okay,
you know what I mean. And for adults, it's like $4 to walk through the entire building. But my exhibit is on the third floor.
Is that the top floor again?
Yeah. So
he only does the penthouse when he does stuff.
If I'm gonna do it, I gotta do it right, and that's the thing.
That's what I say, Aaron.
I just know my worth, and I know what. I have an understanding of the fact that, like, and I don't think this is an arrogant statement, but I think that this is just real. When the Harlem Renaissance was going on, I doubt that those guys were really sitting around saying, like, yo, in 30, 40, 50 years, this is how they're going to tell this story and all of that kind of stuff. They were working.
They were
just doing the work, you know. But one thing that social media and just – the media in general has evolved to at this point is it's so right now and it's so
immediate,
digital and all that kind of stuff that you pretty much have an understanding of how certain stories are going to play out.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for a fact, you know, from just being here and doing this work that 30, 40, 50 years from now, you know, they're not going to be able to tell the story of Baltimore or the story of this whole movement, you know, this Black Lives Matter movement, this movement against oppression and injustice, without talking about the work of people like myself, people like D. Watkins, people like Devin Allen, people like the work that we're doing is not just right now. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I've done certain pieces that have gone so far past what I envision. You know what I mean? Like the image with the two guns on the side of the, like, everybody from Snoop Dogg to T.D. Jakes and, you know what I mean? All these people that got memed to death, you know, like a piece like that, you know, I know for a fact is going to outlive me. You know, pieces of art that I've done.
So basically
I know
what you're saying is that
so,
the work that you're doing, when people look back on Baltimore, they're going to say, Dylon.
Be happy this book is $50. That's all I'm saying.
Well, Aaron, thank you, bro, for coming through.
Thank you.
To hang out with us, to talk about the book. I really appreciate. Were we your first interview so far for this?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Well, the first podcast interview. I've done a couple print ones, but this is the first.
I'm excited.
Me too.
Radio podcast interview. Yeah.
I'm excited. I hope that you all that listen will be excited and pick up a copy of the book. Aaron, what's your Instagram?
Just type in Aaron Maybin on any of your platforms. Aaron Maybin Art, AaronMaybin.
Okay. Jada, you good?
I'm more than good. I'm so excited and inspired. But I was inspired
Jada's
when
about
I
to run through this wall.
I'm serious. I was excited when I first saw his work. So I love it. And I feel like I have a kindred spirit in you.
All right. So we're going to put together that event. We're going to keep you posted. And if you don't have anything else, I guess we out.
Wrapped up.
We're out.
Peace. Mm-hmm.